In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome back to the History Extra End of Roman Britain podcast series. This is episode 4. My name is David Musgrove. I'm your host for this series. Today's guest is Dr. David Petz of Durham University. And the focus of our conversation this time is going to be on late Roman religion and Christianity specifically. As I've done with most of my guests, the first thing I asked David to do was to summarise his position on what happened at the end of Roman Britain. So over to David.
In the 5th century, one of the challenges is we've got two things going on. We've got the end of Roman Britain, and we've got the separate but related issue of the arrival of Germanic cultural influence, and they're not necessarily the same thing. In the old days, we used to think that it was the incoming Anglo-Saxons, which kind of led to the reworking of the conversion of Britain from a Roman state into a Roman province into an early medieval kingdom. Now we think it's more complicated. For me, there are certainly big changes in Roman Britain in the late 4th century, but it's quite clear that Roman Britain was wealthy, important, and an integral part of the empire throughout the 4th century. There are major changes in the 5th century. In the past, people used to think of it as being quite a rapid collapse in the early 5th century. My feeling is that we can see that less as a falling off a cliff and seeing it more now as quite a steep hill. So I think certainly by the time we get into the mid to late 5th century, a lot of those indexes which we would use to think about how Roman Britain is have largely disappeared. So villas are not being built anymore, coinage isn't really being used anymore, ceramics aren't being produced in a large scale anymore. So that's my take on it. Some of these processes are starting in the 4th century, some only get going in the 5th century. But there's more continuities, I think, some people traditionally think, but perhaps less continuity than some other people have claimed.
Right, now what I want to focus on with you in this conversation is religion, which is a topic which you are an expert on. So the nature and any sort of discernible change in the pattern of religious belief and practice over the period would surely help us to understand what might have been going on. So the opening question on that is, how far was late Roman Britain Christian?
Late Roman Britain was definitely an integral part of the wider world of late Roman Christendom. We have bishops, we have churches, we had martyrs before Christianity was made illicit religion. It is as Christian as most of France, chunks of Spain. It's as Christian as anywhere really in the Western Roman Empire.
And you mentioned Christianity being made licit. Can you just remind us of the process of that? When did Christianity become acceptable in the Roman Empire?
Yeah, I mean, the key turning point is the advent of Constantine as emperor of the Roman Empire. He in AD 313, there is something called the Edict of Milan, which essentially makes Christianity a legal or licit religion. And that's basically building on events which have been happening in the Eastern Roman Empire in the year or two before. And from that point, Christianity is fully sanctioned as a religion within the empire. Crucially, it doesn't mean it is the only or official religion of the empire. That doesn't happen until later in the 4th century. But it does mean that the emperors are Christian. Most of the senior bureaucrats, etc., become Christian very rapidly. So although it's not formally a Christian empire, in de facto terms, if you want to progress socially, being Christian is a good idea. And we have a network, an emerging network of an increasingly Christianized army and Christianized bureaucracy.
So it was in people's interest, perhaps, to be Christian within the bounds of the Roman Empire. I wonder, what do we know about Christianity beyond the bounds of the Roman Empire in Britain and Ireland during this period in the fourth century, for instance? Do we know much about how far it extended its reach there?
We don't. We have very little evidence. By the end of the fourth century, there are probably kind of probing out into these areas, but we don't have the archaeological or textual evidence that can really allow us to kind of distinguish between what's happening in, say, the late fourth century and what's happening in the fifth century. Certainly in other parts of the Roman world, though, Christianity is getting beyond the borders. So in places like Armenia, over into the Persian Empire, down into places like Ethiopia and Africa, Christianity does kind of spread quite rapidly. So there's no inherent reason why early Christianity should not be reaching beyond the boundaries of Roman Britain quite rapidly.
And how clear are we about other religious practices that Christianity replaced or that it ran alongside with during this period?
Yeah, I think we need to see it as running alongside. Roman Britain, as with much Roman Empire, it's a world full of gods. There's lots of different religious practices and religious traditions. I think the obvious major change is that the kind of cult of the Roman Empire, the divine emperor, that kind of disappears. Because obviously you can't have a Christian emperor who's himself claiming to be a divinity. But certainly in Britain, it's quite clear that there continues to be a range of other religious practices. So things like Mithraism continues to exist, some of these imported cults from the Eastern Roman Empire. But also, I think the dominant religion through most Roman Britain was a cocktail of local traditions influenced by Roman religious traditions. And certainly they seem to have carried on through the fourth century and quite possibly into the fifth century. We've got evidence that temples are continue to be used. We have evidence for kind of votive practices, kind of carefully structured deposition of ritual items and those kinds of things. So I think although Christianity is important, it's running alongside in the fourth century a host of other kind of religious and ritual traditions.
So am I reading it correctly to say that by the mid to late fourth century, Christianity was kind of part of the fabric, the structure and organization of the Roman Empire?
Yes, it becomes absolutely kind of embedded within the emperor. And crucially, it's the people who are the Christians are the people in power. They are the magistrates, the military. And people like bishops become increasingly absorbed into civil administration. So things like bishops can start to hear civil cases as magistrates, for example. So it's not just the kind of total number of Christians, it's actually who they are and the particular power they have.
So I guess that's historically attested in terms of documentary sources, but in archaeological sources, how far can we be clear how pervasive the influence of Christianity was in Roman Britain?
Yeah, this is where it starts to get complicated. We have clear, unambiguous evidence for the practice of Christianity in the fourth century. We have evidence of Christian symbols on belt buckles, which are used and created in Britain. We have Christian imagery appearing on mosaics. We have Christian imagery appearing on all sorts of objects. So there's clearly a presence of Christians within Britain. What we don't have is really any clear evidence for churches. But this isn't a big problem, because I think there's a tendency for British archaeologists to not understand the nature of the wider archaeology of early Christianity. So actually, if you look in places like Spain or Asia Minor, or even big chunks of Italy, we don't actually have that many surviving 4th century churches over there either. And I think it's more a problem of actually trying to identify churches archaeologically is very, very tricky, particularly from the very earliest phases in the 4th century. So we've got the small finds evidence, we've got documentary evidence, it's just the structural evidence for churches themselves, which we're lacking. But as I said, it's very, very hard to know what a church looks like in the 4th century.
Well, that's really interesting. Do we have a sense about how and where Christianity was practiced then? Presumably not in a church setting that we would recognise today.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we need to think about kind of the church until the beginning of the 4th century is illegal, so pretty much of the empire, effectively. So in practical terms, they're not able to invest in big church buildings because, you know, they might have them, they don't have access to necessarily the funding. It's very high profile to build a large church. So when the church becomes a illicit religion, suddenly they're in a situation where they could have both resources and the social safety and kind of political safety to start building churches. And one of the things they face, they don't actually have an existing architectural repertoire of what a church ought to look like. So what do? They look around, they look for kind of inspiration in the architecture they see in the Roman world. And the kind of plan form which they adopt is the basilica. And the basilica is basically a kind of rectangular building with an apse or like a smaller chamber at one end, where the altar, roughly around that area where the altar would be. You have an entrance in the other short end, and often it's divided into aisles. And actually, that is the kind of plan we see in most churches, well into the medieval world. But in the Roman world, the basilica is used for all sorts of things. It's used for administrative purposes. They can be used for by other religions. So a lot of early Mithraea are essentially basilica. So what we have is they're using an architectural form which is already used by lots of other people. So one of our problems we have is actually how do you tell when you've only got the plan whether the building you're looking at is a early church or a Mithraeum or a guild meeting house or some other administrative structure. And that is a problem in the 4th century. It's not that we don't have churches in Britain. I'm sure that we have churches, but it's an archaeological problem, is that we can't distinguish them from other kinds of building using the same plan.
Okay, so let's go into the 5th century. The early 5th century is this period where we imagine that there is a decline in Roman influence in Britain as the imperial power wanes to an extent. And you said less of a collapse, more of a continual process. But if what you're saying is correct, that sort of Christianity and the structures of Roman power are kind of interlinked, does that mean that we see a decline in Christianity during this period as well?
No, quite the reverse. I think one of the things we see in this period is that the church, first of all, the church, although remains in contact with the continent, whilst the kind of formal reins of power in terms of political government are obviously severed in the early 5th century, we've got clear evidence that the Christian church remains in contact with the mainland church in the Western Roman Empire. So we have bishops like St. Germanus coming over from Gaul in the kind of early to mid 5th century to engage in kind of attempts to try and deal with issues of heresy and disputation within the British church. We have evidence for communications and between British bishops and bishops in Gaul. It's absolutely clear that in terms of individuals, that there continues to be a communication between Britain and the wider church. And this is sometimes one of these kind of myths that come the end of Roman Britain, suddenly Britain is isolated and the British church is isolated. It's not. It's part of the wider world. So we see that in terms of the people and the textual sources. Also, we see that in terms of other things. The most obvious is that we see those continued connections in terms of burial traditions. So in the 5th century, we have a flowering of new types of grave marker. with Latin inscriptions on. They're found in areas of Britain where there's never a real tradition of Roman grave monuments. So I'm thinking places like we have them, these new Latin stones, in places like southwest England, Wales particularly, in getting up into areas of southern Scotland. And these are grave markers which have Latin inscriptions using particular kind of epitaphs and burial formula. And they are absolutely identical in terms of the inscriptions with very similar monuments found across the Western Roman Empire. They have same kind of phrases used, and it shows that, you know, we are really part of a shared community of burial practice in Western Britain, specifically. You know, they clearly have parallels in what's going on in Gaul and Spain and North Africa and Italy.
So let's take a pause for a moment, because this seems quite important. We've heard in earlier episodes there might have been something of a dislocation in terms of political and military structures between Britain and the rest of the empire in the 5th century. But what David's saying here is that Christianity endures as a connecting force to some extent. I wanted to just check in and ask him if he felt that Christianity was used by people who wanted to try to demonstrate that they were in some way culturally Roman still.
Yeah, I think this is really important. I think in Western Britain, Christianity provides a vicarious way of still participating in the Roman world culturally, even though there's no longer those direct political connections. So the church, it provides a network of links and fellowship, and it's an intellectual network which allows people in Britain, in Western Britain particularly, to continue to be part of that kind of wider cultural world, particularly the Latin cultural world of the Western Roman Empire. So, you know, I think one of the really interesting things is we see from these tombstones is they're written in Latin. You know, they're not written in any of the indigenous languages of Britain. People are clearly continuing to use Latin as the language of public memorialization. It's clearly a way of being part of a network of the Roman world, culturally, if not politically, and it provides a way of making that kind of material, making it physical. You build a church, and you know, a churchman from Italy could probably end up in a church in Britain and still kind of know what that building was for and why he was there. And equally, a priest from somewhere like kind of South Wales could end up in a church in central Gaul and be, you know, welcomed as a fellow member of the community of Christ.
So that's really interesting, I think, because you mentioned earlier in one of your answers that we have this idea of an isolated land, and you disagree with that. And what you're saying there is that there is a lot of connection, a lot of interactivity going on. So are you imagining quite a reasonable flow of people going between the Christian parts of post-Roman Britain and the continent?
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking kind of, you know, roll-off ferries of clerics kind of stopping in northern France. But what's clear is I think those connections are continuous. They are connections forged in the 4th century, and they continue to be carried on unbroken through the 5th century. There's certainly changes perhaps in the specific routes. So for example, it's quite clear that in the 5th century and into the 6th century, the kind of the Atlantic routes down the kind of west of Britain, down the west of France towards Spain, they were perhaps more important than, whereas in the 4th century, connections directly across the English Channel to kind of northern Gaul were perhaps more important. But In the longer term, those connections are kind of all joining up in the Mediterranean. They're connections leading to Rome, leading to the East Mediterranean. So, yes, people are moving. It's not just necessarily specifically churchmen. There's increasing evidence from things like bone isotopes of people from the Mediterranean being buried in places like Wales. We're not a huge number, but you know, we're only sampling a very small number of cemeteries in the first place. So it's clear there continue to be connections, and there's trade connections. We see imported objects from the Eastern Mediterranean, potteries particularly, coming up into Britain in this period as well. So Christianity is just one of a series of existing of links which are nurtured and maintained in the 5th century.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Tintagel's a place, I think, if I remember rightly, where we have good sort of material evidence for trade, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Tintagel is the classic example of somewhere which has a large assemblage of amphora, Roman amphora, and fine wares, and increasingly getting a good understanding of some of the coarse wares as well. And these are all things produced in North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean. And it's clear when you look at the kind of wider distribution that there's a communication route exporting these objects from the kind of Mediterranean world up through the gates of Gibraltar, up the west coast, and boats are stopping in Spain, in Portugal, northern Spain, Bordeaux, and then reaching up to Britain. And you say this is a world of trading and exchange, and there's probably things like leather and other goods coming from Western Britain heading back down, and also most notably in the Cornish context, tin. But it's interesting when you look at what this pottery is. We've got the fine tablewares, but which are kind of nice to eat off. But the amphora are containing wine and oil. And to celebrate the Christian Mass, you need wine for the communion, and to anoint people to carry out all sorts of church rituals, you need oil, olive oil. So I'm not necessarily suggesting that the church are driving that trade, but they clearly have an interest in the materials which are coming up from the Mediterranean world.
And I should have mentioned for listeners who aren't familiar with British geography, Tintagel is of course a lovely little place on the north coast of Cornwall in the peninsula in the southwest there, famous for its links to King Arthur, but we probably won't go there in this conversation. So we talked quite a lot about the sort of what's happening more in the west of Britain, I guess. Is it a completely different situation in the east of England if you follow that narrative of there being a big migration or even an invasion of people from continental Europe into eastern England then, and particularly people who weren't Christian, then you would expect to see a big dislocation in religious practice. Is that evidenced?
Yeah, absolutely. We certainly have major cultural change, and no matter how we frame it as migration or elite, no matter how we think of it, it's clear there is a big cultural change. And first of all, what's important is the areas where we see this biggest cultural change are the areas which were most Romanized and thus most Christianized in the 4th century. So whilst it's possible that places like St. Albans, the cult of St. Alban, who is a Roman martyr, may have continued, or almost certainly continued in this period, for the majority of the population, it appears that they are shedding their Roman beliefs, whether that's Roman Christianity or Roman paganism, and adopting a new kind of Germanic set of pagan Christian pagan religious beliefs. This is really important because it means that this is the kind of the unspoken conversion. We always think about this period, we think about conversion to Christianity. But in the east of Britain, where we've got the east of England and south of England particularly, where we have these new Germanic influences or possible Germanic influences, what we're seeing is another major period of religious change. So a family who over three or four generations in, say, somewhere like Suffolk, they could have gone through being kind of in the mid-4th century, Roman pagan converting to Roman Christian, and then in the later 5th century, converting back to a new kind of paganism, but a more Germanic-influenced paganism. So there's a lot going on there. The religious world is quite fluid.
Time for a quick step back, because we're going to talk a lot more about the issue of migration and population movement in the post-Roman period in future episodes. Now, this question of fluidity of religion that David just talked about perhaps helps explain why, by the end of the 6th century, the Pope, Gregory, felt obliged to send a mission under Augustine to bring Christianity back. So I wanted to check in with David to find out what we know about this mission.
Right, we've got a situation. I mean, one of the things we know about Augustine, he arrives and he actually meets British bishops in the west of England. So there's clearly an established church, and as I already mentioned, we've got documentary evidence that there's a well-established church in the west of Britain. So you've got the writings of Gildas, and British bishops sometimes pop up at church councils, and then there's all sorts of textual sources. So we've got when Augustine arrives, certainly the world he's coming straight into, the Anglo-Saxon world, is pagan. But beyond that, you know, and we're talking about an area which perhaps comprises maybe half of the landmass, maybe even more of Britain, we've got a well-established church. And crucially, by this point, the church has spread beyond the bounds of the former Roman Empire. So we can't necessarily spot that in the 4th century, but by the time we get into the 5th century, and certainly by the time we get into the 6th century, it's clear that Christianity has spread across a lot of Scotland, certainly the kind of broadly the west and south, and crucially Ireland becomes a bastion of Christianity. So when Augustine arrives, he's not just necessarily confronting British bishops, indigenous British bishops. These are bishops with connections with Ireland, with up into Scotland, and of course these bishops themselves are British bishops, are connected with the existing church. So it's not, as I said, we often get this idea that the British church is somehow kind of isolated and lacking in connection. And part of that is that's the story that people like Bede want us to think. They want us to think that the Anglo-Saxon bishops were the good bishops and the British bishops were kind of dangerously unorthodox and out of contact. So a lot of our stories about the early church are kind of seen through a fairly partial and biased documentary record coming out of the Anglo-Saxon church.
Now, I've blundered here because I've been guilty of letting the conversation rush too far forward by charging on to the story of Augustine's mission. We can't really cover the role of Christianity in the 5th century in Britain without mentioning a certain Saint Patrick, whose dates are uncertain, but he was probably alive at this time. I asked David for a summary of his importance to the story.
Oh, Saint Patrick's a really exciting figure because he is the one person we've got who kind of crosses connects the late Roman church with the early medieval church. We don't precisely know where Patrick comes from. He's probably comes from somewhere in Western Britain, within the Roman world. But crucially, we know that his father and grandfather were both Roman Christians. Patrick's kind of, the date of Patrick is a bit kind of unclear, but certainly his father and probably certainly his grandfather and almost certainly his father were Romano-British people living in the late 4th century. And one was a priest and one was a deacon. So Patrick is emerging out of that Romano-British Christian context. But crucially, Patrick is taken as a slave to Ireland, where he escapes. He goes back to train training as a missionary. He goes back to Ireland and he starts that conversion process. Actually, he's following on from an earlier figure called Palladius, who's probably also sent as a missionary to Ireland. But Patrick's the one we know more about, and Patrick is clearly British, whereas Palladius is coming from somewhere else. So this is that kind of connection between Britain and Roman Britain and Ireland. And it's really important because Ireland, again, is an area which was outside the Roman world, but it converts to Christianity. And by the kind of 6th century, it's well, the church is really, really well established. And then, of course, from Ireland, we then have further missionaries going into kind of Western Scotland, and they are then going up into the Pictish world. And of course, you know, in the 6th century, Irish priests are then going back down into Europe, people like Columbanus, and kind of reviving and stimulating Christianity back down in what had been the Western Roman Empire. So the role of Ireland is incredibly, incredibly important. And it's really interesting because Ireland has those clear connections with both the Roman continental church under Palladius, but also Patrick. He is a Romano-British man. He is not somebody from Gaul. He's not someone from Rome. It's clear that that major impulse of conversion of Ireland is coming from Roman Britain itself.
So I hope that was a useful summary of St. Patrick's role in the story and gets us back on track. St. Patrick brings back into sharper focus what was happening in Western Britain and Ireland and the importance of the development of the church there, as David explains. But words of the wise, whatever you do, if you ever bump into David or his academic colleagues who work in this area, do not be tempted to start talking about the Celtic Church.
I don't like the term the Celtic Church. And it's one of these terms which has kind of escaped into popular culture and is very, very hard to kind of get rid of. There's very few academics and researchers working in this period who would use the idea of the Celtic Church today. And it's something which has been criticized for knocking on 30, 40 years, but it's a very potent idea. So essentially the idea of the Celtic Church is that we have the churches of Wales, kind of Cornwall, Scotland, Ireland, and Brittany, who are the areas of the world which spoke Celtic languages. There's the idea that somehow these churches share something in common which makes them similar and makes them somehow distinguishes them particularly from the kind of the Roman church as broadly understood. The trouble is this doesn't actually bear much scrutiny. A lot of the ideas, like things like the dates of Easter, it's quite clear that the date of Easter was celebrated at different times in different parts of the Celtic world. The idea that Roman missionaries or Anglo-Saxon missionaries had to bring the correct date, it doesn't really bear out. So some parts of the Irish church are celebrating the dates differently already when Augustine arrives in Britain. There's some differences in things like monastic haircut, but we don't know how far that was spread. And the idea that kind of, you know, priests in the south of Brittany in the 6th century, in Cornwall in the 9th century, newly minted Pictish converts in the 7th century, and well-established Irish bishops in Armagh in the 8th century are somehow all part of a shared kind of Celtic church just doesn't work. I think a lot of the idea, again, is rooted in this notion of Britain and Ireland being isolated from what's happening in the continent. More widely, if you look at the church on a kind of, you know, European scale, what's clear is there's all sorts of local differences. What's happening in, say, North Africa in the 6th century is very different from what's happening in the church in central France. And it's very different from what's happening in the church in kind of places like the Balkans. There's lots of local traditions. There's lots of churches working and praying and building churches in slightly different ways. So there's lots and lots of regional traditions. But what you can't do is draw a fault line that somehow separates off everything in the far northwest of Europe, in the Celtic-speaking countries, from everything else. There's lots of variety. Yes, the Church of Ireland is very, very different from what's happening in, say, Sicily, but equally it's very different from what's happening in Brittany. And the Church of Sicily is very different from what's happening in northern Spain. So there's lots and lots of what the great scholar of late antiquity, Peter Brown, has called micro-Christianities. There's lots and lots of different ways of being a Christian. There's different ways to build a church. There's different ways to illuminate a manuscript. There's different ways to bury somebody. So what's more interesting is actually all these smaller regional variations rather than trying to make a fairly crude distinction between the Celts and the not Celts.
Okay, so you've clearly flagged up the dangers of generalization. I'm going to ask you to generalize now. So to wrap up, how does our understanding of what happened in terms of religious practice through the fifth century help us to understand what was going on more widely in terms of social change and population change, political change?
I think what's clear is the fourth, fifth century is clearly a period of change. Absolutely, there's no getting around that. There's a political separation from Roman Empire, and that then has social and economic impacts. But we've got to try and think about this on multiple different axes. It's not just about politics and economics. Christianity is perhaps the key area where we do see continuity. It's the bridge. It's that kind of cord that continues to connect Britain with what's going on in the wider Roman world. It's Christianity provides a way of people to connect themselves conceptually, culturally with the wider Roman world, and of course, very specifically, the British bishops, the British and Irish and Scottish Christians of the 5th and 6th century, they are part of the wider world of Christendom. We have that archaeologically, we have that in terms of documentary sources. It's not an isolated thing. The British and Irish and Scottish churches are integral to what's happening in terms of religion and social change. Also, Christianity is really important, whether we like it or not, because by the time we get to the end of the first millennium, Europe, apart from very small areas on the periphery, is a Christian world, and Christianity is something which is central to the kind of self-identity of Western Europe in this period, and it becomes the dominant religion. So, and we see that impact again on belief, but also in things like economy. So much land is given to the church in this period; it fundamentally kind of reshapes aspects of kind of wider social world. So the church is really, really important. One doesn't have to kind of like the church or dislike the church or have, you know, believe in any of these things. But it's clear that the emergence of this, it's an entirely new social body. It's an entirely new institution which operates in a way that no Roman religion ever did. So it's incredibly important, and it's one of the underlying factors that leads to the transformation of what you might call the classical or late antique world into the early medieval world.
So you've been listening there to Dr. David Petz, Associate Professor of Archaeology at the University of Durham and an expert on the social archaeology of the entire first millennium, but particularly with an interest in Christianity. And in fact, I talked to him for the podcast a little while ago about Lindisfarne, Holy Island. So if you want to look out for that, then search through the catalogue to have a look. I hope that has been a useful explanation of the place and role of Christianity and religion generally in our story. And next time around, I'll be talking to Dr. James Gerard to find out more about what actually happened as we move into the post-Roman period.